Well, hey, cousins, you are listening to Revolutionary Hood Rap with Kim Young of Dope Black Social Worker, and I am back. I know I wasn't here last week, but I'm back now. Or has it been 2 weeks? I think I'm losing track of time. So much life is happening in a very small amount of time where, like, which way is up, which way is down, but I'm here now. I'm here now. So let's go ahead and get into our revolutionary news for the week, which goes out to Jay Lang. Jay is a first-generation, second-year student, bachelor student at Virginia Commonwealth University's social work program. Shout out to VCU social work program, because y'all know that's where I went and got my little MSW, built my little family, had a little bit of graduate school trauma, but I still ride hard for all of the students that are making their way through VCU's bachelor's and master's and PhD level programming. So shout out to Jay, who was named an emerging leader by the Virginia Housing Alliance. Jay is someone who experienced homelessness and housing instability from a teenager up into their early 20s. And so they are incredibly passionate about the housing field and currently work for Marsha and Marion's Neighbors. So shout out to the whole Marsha and Marion Neighbors team, especially those peer navigators. Y'all hold that shit down. So y'all are really appreciated. If you are not familiar with Marsha and Marion's Neighbors, it is a shared housing program in Richmond, Virginia, for young adults ages 18 to 24 who are either pregnant, parenting, or identify as LGBTQ+, and they are currently experiencing homelessness. And so shout out to Jay, who, when I was reading through the article, they mentioned, like, you know, they were born a social worker and that they're going to die a social worker, that they knew what social work was before they actually got introduced to the field and started doing the work. And so shout out to Jay for being seen, for really showing the power of, you know, following in a path that's meant for you and living in your purpose and then finding meaning along the way and developing the tools and relationships needed to help you have the greatest impact you would love to have in the fields and in the population that you find the most joy serving. And so, Jay, we see you. We thank you. We honor you for your service and for your commitment and for just being dope in this field. Like, there's more folks like you are needed in the field of social work, especially just early on in the career, and for you, like, still finishing school and doing dope shit. And so shout out to Jay and all the other social work students who are seen and unseen for their tireless efforts, right, of serving the communities where they feel they can have the greatest impact. So that is our revolutionary news for the week. Let's get into some Earth is Ghetto, because truth be told, y'all, we got some shit to talk about. And I don't even know, like, what order of events that we need to engage in this conversation, because we still haven't talked about Daughters, the documentary that had me boohooing, crying my entire, you know, my life out a couple of weeks ago. So we definitely got to talk about Daughters. We definitely got to talk about Chimp Crazy. Because if y'all have not seen or started watching Chimp Crazy on HBO Max with that white woman breastfeeding them monkeys, we got to talk about Chimp Crazy. We also got to talk about Cam Newton and Dr. Cheyenne Bryant and this whole discourse around low functioning, low value, high functioning, high value, and Cam literally just spreading his seed along everywhere in the earth and the birthing all these babies and creating all these households who he does not have the capacity to fully care for outside of financial means. But I think where we're going to start is me recapping my experience of traveling to Madison, Wisconsin last week to attend and keynote the Anesis Therapy Multicultural Mental Health Conference. And so it was the inaugural conference, and I'm really grateful for the team, for Myra, the founder of Anesis, for, you know, seeing me and being willing to invest in me literally and just spiritually, honestly, and bringing me to Madison, Wisconsin to deliver a keynote, but then really surround me with so much warmth and so much care in a very unfamiliar environment. And so transparently, that was my first trip to what is known as the Midwest in the United States of America, which is the, you know, central northern part of the country. I'm a coastal baby through and through, born on the West Coast in California, currently living on the East Coast in Virginia. Much of my family situated in the South in Louisiana. So, coast all the way around. Do not have family, relationships, any reason, right, outside of just curiosity or travel to go to the Midwest. And so to have this opportunity to visit the Midwest for the first time, really didn't know what to expect. You kind of hear stories about the middle of America. Some people unaffectionately refer to it as flyover country, which in many ways is like that just reduces a lot of it, just reduces the region, but then also it takes away from the people who that is home, that's a culture, that's where they love, work, play, raise their families, exist, fight, change, all of these things. So it's more than just flyover country. It is a real place and it is home to a lot of people. And so to have a chance to travel there for the first time and with purpose and intention was a real unique, rewarding experience. It was also an insightful experience that brought greater clarity to me and woke my ass up. Because we don't talk about this enough, like living along the coastal parts of this country and what that means for, I'm gonna say, like, diversity or just the ways in which politics is understood, social conditioning is understood, the way we relate, don't relate, segregate, isolate, integrate, assimilate, all of these things with each other along the coast, and how there's a greater variety of individuals just from various backgrounds and identities and experiences that are kind of situated along the coastal parts of the United States. And as you kind of go inward away from the coast, it seems like a lot of that just begins to fall away. And so I just had blinders on, right? So not fully aware, but had some level of awareness of just America. But they're really not lying when they say, if you really want to know, if you want to check like the pulse of this country, you got to go to the Midwest. You got to go to Middle America to really check the pulse of the country, because anywhere else will have your ass delusional. Delusional. And so I'm saying that because when I got to many, what I forgot what my connecting airport was, but it was not Atlanta. Let me tell you some shit right now, because as somebody who lives in Richmond, Virginia, oftentimes when I'm headed somewhere by plane, I either go through Atlanta, Georgia, or Charlotte, North Carolina. Like those be the options to get you up out of Virginia to go where you need to go. Like those are the connecting airports. And so when you're in Charlotte or when you're in Atlanta waiting at the airport to get on your next plane, it just be people of all types of hues and lives, and just people that look different, look like you, different types of people. Y'all, I'm sitting in the airport in Wisconsin, waiting to catch my other plane to Madison, Wisconsin. I looked around, everybody waiting to get on this goddamn plane was white. I said, oh shit. Okay, welcome to Wisconsin, girl. Like, let's get it together. But at the same time, it also made me tap into these other skills that I've just developed over the years of existing in this body. All right, bet I'm the only white person to get on this plane. Let me also sit down or at the gate, right, in a row of chairs where my back is against the wall and I can see everything and everybody that's happening, right? Like that's just one of the things that I do subconsciously. As a safety measure, when I find myself being the only Black person, but especially the only Black woman in a space, is I will situate myself like up against a wall so nobody's behind me, but then also closer to the edge of a row so that if I need to get up or move, I can do that without any obstruction, right? That's just what it comes with being Black in America, is you're always thinking about your safety, especially in moments like that. And so, like, I'm waiting to get on the plane. Everybody's white. I said, this is going to be very, very interesting. Very interesting. So I land in Madison, Wisconsin. Airport, very easy to navigate, not too many people. I am greeted by the lovely Myra and Alina from Anisa's Therapy. They were holding the sign for me. It was like, welcome to Madison, cousin Kim. I said, oh my God, look at my cousins. This is going to be good. Like, we all right. I see Black and brown faces. My nervous system is starting to regulate. We're gonna be all right. And so I'm debriefing with them about just my travel experience. And then, they're taking me to lunch to also meet other members of their team. We're eating lunch outside. It's a table of, I think there's like five or six just black and brown women conversing, being ourselves, eating, you know, in community, in conversation, cracking jokes, sharing stories, sharing insights, all of these things, right? All of a sudden, like this is, we have been there at least like an hour and a half, I would say, uninterrupted, unfiltered, black and brown joy. All of a sudden, there's this white woman that's sitting behind us while we're, you know, finishing up our meal and our conversation. And she's kind of looking, I can kind of see her out of my peripheral. And I'm like, what's going on with her? So she's kind of looking, and, you know, she got that face like, oh, like so eager. I want to be involved in this conversation. Oh my goodness. Then all of a sudden she says to us, oh my goodness, it looks like you ladies are having such a great time. We're just like, oh, yeah, because girl, ain't nobody talking to you. But then also it clicks in my mind, like, here go white women asserting themselves in situations and places where you were not invited to. Like, lady, you could just sit over there, mind your business, eat your food with who you brought to have lunch with and leave us alone. But that's not what she did. So she says, like, oh my goodness, it looks like you ladies are having such a great time, so much fun. I wish I could be a part of your conversation. I can't help but overhear what you all are talking about because you're so loud. Everybody's like, okay. Because girl. I'm going to stop the story right there because it gets progressively worse. But there's like these two inflection points where at any moment we could have been like, bitch, shut the fuck up. Like, ain't nobody talking to you. Like, turn back around and do what you was doing. Like, why are you even talking to us? But also understanding the impact of responding that way and how many times black and brown peoples, especially black and brown women, when moments of like that happen, where you literally have to run through all these safety checks in your head and like checks and balances of like what makes sense in the situation, what's going to keep me safe, what's going to keep the people I'm with safe, what's not going to cause this to escalate, when many times you want to be like, fuck all of this shit, I'm about to flip this table, because why are you saying this to me? Why are you talking to me? Yes, it's that big of a deal, right? But like, we don't exist in a world where we get to have raw emotion without real consequences. And so we're all just like, oh, okay. And then it gets to the point, you know, one of the women we were having lunch with has beautiful, big black hair. Like, there's like black tech, you know, textured hair, kinky curly hair, but it's also colorful. It's blue. So it's blue, it's colorful, it's big and it's beautiful. And here comes this white woman, literally getting up, crouching over, her hands are out like a praying mantis, and she's walking over and saying, oh, your hair is, oh, I'm gonna do her voice, your hair is just so beautiful, I have to touch it. Have to? She didn't ask, she didn't say, can I touch it? She said, I have to touch it. And everybody at the table was like, no. Like, no, you cannot touch your hair. Like, no, we're not doing that. You cannot touch your hair. But y'all, do y'all think it stopped this woman? She got so close where she was literally about to put her hands out and touch her hair. When you have a table full of five black women being like, no, you cannot touch your hair. What are you doing? Even the one she's approaching is like, no. Like putting her hands out, like, no, that's no, you can't touch it. No, that's good. Like, you can admire it from far away. No, you can't touch my hair. And I'm sitting there like, this is really happening. Because, you know, I have existed in a bubble, for lack of better words, of like, I literally forgot that we were still living in a world where white women are still trying to pet black people. I forgot this world still existed in the year of 2024, that we still have white women out here touching, without permission, black and brown bodies, and thinking nothing is wrong with it, because this woman did not apologize. She didn't say, oh, my bad, I'm so sorry. Nothing. She literally went back with like her little smirk or smile and set her ass back down until whoever she had lunch with joined her, and they walked off into the sunset, wherever the hell they went. But it's like, what? So that was my introduction to Madison, Wisconsin, or just Wisconsin in general. Was like, wow, like white women are the same everywhere. And I know that's a generalized statement, but at the core, it is just true. It is just true, right? The entitlement and the freedom to move in a world with limited consequences and to know that you can behave without getting your face smashed and your ass cussed out. Even though in a lot of these situations, that should be rightly deserved. But on the flip side of that, we know we can't respond or behave that way because of the grave consequences if we do. Because imagine if that table full of five black and brown women, she getting over like a praying mantis, hopping, getting ready to touch somebody's hair. We pick up a chair and mollywop that bitch across her head. Then what? But we know that can't happen. And if we, even if we don't pick up the chair, like put your hand out and give her a good baby stiff arm where she fall down, then all of a sudden she done broke her hip. And then now you on the news and you getting carted off to jail. So that was my introduction to Wisconsin. It got better though. It got better in terms of, being in the community that was created by this multicultural mental health conference and really seeing the need for having something like that in a place like Madison. And then also being able to deliver a message specifically for Black and Brown people in that space that I did for my keynote. I know that I activated the nervous system of white people, but I promise you, I don't care. I never have, and I don't today. And so I talked about an imposter syndrome and how it is a fraud. There's nothing factual about imposter syndrome when it comes to Black and Brown bodies, when it comes to oppressed bodies. And so really deconstructing and challenging these narratives of imposter syndrome, which was created by these two white women that only primarily studied 95% of their, sample group for their original research for imposter syndrome were middle-aged white women that were quote unquote high achieving. And many of them held like, advanced degrees, and they had these various professions from social workers, educators, nurses, lawyers, all of these things. So it was primarily white women. And the researchers found all of these kind of traits of what they determined was like self-imposed imposters of like, feel like you don't belong. All this other kind of bullshit. When we know when it comes to Black, Brown, oppressed bodies, we're not imposters. We have been systematically excluded. That's a difference. Meaning like these tables were never set for us. These jobs were never meant for us. These organizations don't position us. We have been systematically excluded. We're not imposters by any means. We were never welcome to begin with. We were never considered to be high achieving to begin with. And so releasing this idea that that belongs to us and giving imposter syndrome back to these two white women who created this shit to begin with, and shifting our understanding to this idea of like, we have already and we are a brilliant people. When you deal with these high levels of oppression and exclusion and violence, right? Political violence, physical violence, all of it, there, and you survive it for generations, there's a brilliance in that. There's no way that people who are marginalized, people who are minoritized, people who are systematically oppressed are not brilliant people. There's absolutely no way. And so to shift our understanding, like we are brilliant by nature. We do not have to try to be these things. We are, is critical for our own survival, moving from survival into thriving and fully existing, reclaiming our bodies and our joy and our rest, and understanding that it is not our duty or responsibility to deconstruct or solve for white people's problems like supremacy and capitalism. We didn't create this shit. We don't benefit from it, and we don't have the tools to dismantle it. They do. White folks do. And so for me, like to say that out loud in a room of 500 people, I didn't realize that like those just aren't the conversations happening openly in a place like Madison, Wisconsin, but it definitely upset some folks in the crowd. But more than that, it liberated so many other people. I can't even tell you the countless amount of folks who came up to me after my talk to just thank me. Some crying, some making me emotional as well. It's just like needing to be poured into. And for me, you already know, I say this before y'all, like if I have it to give, I'm gonna give it. If I don't have it to give, I'm not gonna give it. I had it to give that day to be able to pour into people, to help set them on the path of their own internal liberation. It's just like investigating these narratives. And so to be able to do that in a space like that, in a city like that, in a state like that, where what I came to understand deeper is, you know, a lot of Black and brown folks are just invisible in Wisconsin, right? So like, how do we increase the visibility of us in spaces like that in an overwhelmingly white world? And I know, right, my brain knows how white this country is, but not the world. The world is not as white as this country makes itself to be. The world is very melanated. But this country makes itself to be incredibly white. And then to go to a place like Wisconsin and see it reflected back, I was like, God damn. Because I just haven't existed or lived in a place like that, where like you really, that's what you saw, right? But I'm really grateful to have had the opportunity to travel to the Midwest. It's not going to be my last time. People told me like, girl, you got to go to Milwaukee. Don't let Madison be your only taste of Wisconsin. You got to go to Milwaukee. I said, I'll pull up. Whatever's going down, I'm just not coming in the winter months. Y'all, shit. Hell no. I don't do snow. And I don't do wind, snow, ice. I don't do the double digit negative. I don't do none of that shit. So I pull up in the spring, the fall, the summer, whenever. But I ain't coming in the winter. But I'm going to come check out other parts of the Midwest. There's so much that I want to learn, so much that I want to experience. I'm really curious about the social and cultural conditions of not just the quote unquote like urban areas of the Midwest, but just like the context of it all. The context of it all. And so shout out to everybody, every cousin I had a chance to connect with, talk with, take a picture with, hug, whatever may have happened. Like, y'all really poured back into me in a way that left my cup overflowing as I got back on a plane to come back to Black ass Richmond, Virginia. I'm not going to spend too much time talking about Daughters, the documentary. Because I think I want to have a guest on here to join me in conversation about Daughters, because it'll make for a richer experience, I think, for me and for anybody that's listening. But if you're not familiar with Daughters, it's a documentary that is currently on Netflix. It is co-directed by Angela Patton, who is a hometown Shiro here in Richmond, Virginia. So Angela has the founder of this organization called Girls for a Change, which has been operating here in the city of Richmond, but then also in other parts of the country for well over a decade. And I still remember when the whole team at Girls for a Change and Angela led the charge of having the first father-daughter dance here in Richmond at the city jail, the old city jail, not this new justice center, but like the jail, the brick building jail. And so I remember like the conversations of, you know, in the community, like, what is she trying to, why are we having dances at the jail? That's the jail. Then you have some people like, oh yeah, that's a beautiful idea. Like the daughters need to be able to see their fathers and have a moment and experience together. And so I still recall that happening here in Richmond. And though to sit and experience this documentary, it was, heartbreaking during moments. It was joyful during moments. It was hopeful during moments. And then it was just settled me right back into the reality of what things are and how everything is so intentionally designed to create a situation like this, where fathers are removed from their households and families, and kids are literally out in the world without the proper love, care, protection, and guidance of their other co-creator, right? Like all of that is not by chance. That shit is incredibly intentional. And so to see the fathers who participate in the program, it's a multi-week program where if they go through, you know, all of the classes, they can end up attending this dance where their daughters are able to like physically be in a space with them. And they can create memories and share physical touch and hugs and all types of stuff. And I will say the girls that they followed in the documentary in particular, it was Santana. It was Santana and Bree. I think it was that other baby. who, yeah, it was definitely, yeah, Santana. Santana was the one that like broke my heart because, you know, she was born to very young parents. And you could clearly see how that baby don't know what being a child is. And like how many young people, like that is their life, right? Where you were literally not growing up with your parents, but in many ways, like you grow up beyond your parents. And I've had to have that conversation more than I would like when I was doing direct service with young people who like their, you know, their mom would have them when they were 14 or 15. And I was working with a kid who was like 16 and he couldn't understand why his mom would do certain things. And I had to just kind of explain to him, like, hey, you've been able to hit some developmental milestones your mother has not hit. Like you have literally like developed in these very specific ways beyond your mom. And so, yeah, like you fully deserve to have this love and care and protection and rules and like all of these things that you're the structure, all these things you're desiring. But baby, I'm gonna tell you something. Your mother cannot give that to you. Right. And so watching Santana was like watching a lot of other young people that I have encountered who were also birthed to very young parents who just didn't have the tools that they needed to support and raise and nurture their own children. And so she really broke my heart, especially when she would talk to her dad and just be like, you know, wanting to believe what he said, but not trusting that he would keep his word and not get in trouble again. 'Cause she was like, I'm tired of like believing that he gonna stay out of jail. 'Cause like, you know, when I do that, he just let me down and he back in jail. But I will say he was one of the fathers towards the end of the documentary who did end up getting released. And I'm hoping that he don't let that girl down because she gave me the type of energy where like, if you let her down one more time, that shit is done. And not just done for like the father, like done for any other adult, any other healthy relationship. That shit is, it's a wrap if she gets let down again. So she broke my heart and then Bree broke my heart because that was a young baby who was filled with so much love and energy and curiosity and hope for her dad, and just her family in general. And I'm gonna tell you, I'm not gonna tell the whole story, but by the end of the documentary, when they follow back up with her after maybe a year or two, she was over it. That baby lost the light in her eyes. She was over it. And so, like I said, I'm gonna stop right there. I'm not gonna go into the themes and these other kind of ideas that I've and you know that I've jotted down because I would love to be in conversation with somebody else about not just the daughter's documentary, but just this dynamic of Black girls and their fathers. And I think I have an idea of who I would like to chat with. But if y'all have some suggestions, like hit me up and let me know. Slide in my DM, send me an email at contact@dopeblacksocialworker.com if you have an idea of like who I can chat with about Black girls and father dynamics. And next, though, when we talk about father dynamics, we got to talk about Cam Newton and Dr. Cheyenne Bryant. I don't know if y'all had a chance or if you saw like this. I know there's a couple of viral clips floating around, but there's also a 2.5 hour interview that's available on YouTube. So Cam Newton is a retired NFL player. He played for like I think over a decade or so, primarily with the Carolina Panthers. He was drafted number one during his draft class. He was a Heisman Trophy winner, all the shit. So Cam has a podcast. It's called Funky Fridays. The name, I don't understand, but it don't gotta make sense to me. It makes sense to him, and he get his bag. So it is what it is. So he has this podcast, and he had Dr. Cheyenne Bryant on this podcast. So I was introduced to Dr. Bryant a couple of months ago because she was also on Nick Cannon's podcast called Cancel Culture, and I was like fascinated by Dr. Bryant when she was on Nick Cannon's podcast because she has an approach and her doctorate is in counseling psychology, if I'm not mistaken. So she has like 17 years in the field of psychology, mental health therapy, but she currently coaches. And then she's also, I think, the president or something of the Los Angeles NAACP. And then she also runs her own company. So she considers herself a coach, currently and doesn't practice therapy. But you know, once them skills is there, them skills be there. But anyways, like I was fascinated and deeply impressed by the way in which she handled herself and that conversation with Nick Cannon. that of course, when I saw the one with Cam Newton pop up, I was like, oh, I'm locked in. Let's watch it. All 2.5 hours, I sat up there and watched it. And I listened to the audio separately, right? So I spent 5 hours of my Black time listening to and or watching this interview with Cam Newton and Dr. Brian, because it was a masterclass in like using therapeutic listening and reflection, using really deliberate confrontation, standing on business. Because there were so many times when Cam Newton would try to deflect or try to minimize or try to like equate his educational background with her educational background, or discredit her understanding of concepts and theories. And like, even when he would share stuff, he would find ways to poke holes in what she shared by reflecting back that, like, you know, she don't have kids or that she's not married. So how she could be a relationship coach? How does she know what she's talking about? All types of foolishness. But what really stood out to me in the conversation, and I think for a lot of people, and it's been like a trigger, truth be told, is she talked a lot about like low functioning, high functioning, low value and high value. And I could tell from her conversation with Nick Cannon how, you know, low functioning is a trigger. And it was also a trigger for Cam Newton. And they really had such a hard time separating low function or just functioning from value. Right. Or don't even put high or low on it, but just functioning from value. And there is a difference, right? So value, the way that she explained it to him very patiently and several times, has a lot to do with like what you have to offer to in relationship dynamics, like what you have to offer to a relationship, if that's financial security, if that's relationships, other type of resources, stability, whatever it is, right? Your value, what are you bringing in terms of like these tangible resources? The functioning is more or less like, how are you showing up in these relationships? So value, what are you bringing? Functioning, how are you showing up? And he had such a hard time of not conflating the two things, but it's not just him. I see the discourse on the internet. A lot of people are having a hard time separating functioning from value, because they're hearing like, nah, because I'm able to provide, that I'm able to do X, Y, and Z, like my functioning is high. No, no, no. Your value is high because you have access and resources and means to provide, but your function is quite low in terms of what are your, you know, I kind of think about functioning in the realm of executive functioning skills. So like, which are like these set of skills that help us plan, meet our goals, control our emotions, regulate emotions, control ourselves, follow through with tasks, like all these different things that kind of help us show up and function in the world, function in relationships, function at jobs, all types of stuff. And so when you really think about these different type of executive functioning skills, and depending on like what school of thought you pull from, there's between like 8 or 12 different skills. The ones that I'm familiar with are like flexible thinking, your working memory, self-monitoring, planning and prioritizing, initiating tasks, organizing, impulse control, emotional control. And I know there's some other ones that people also refer to. When you think about like these different executive functioning skills domains, a lot of people actually struggle with stress tolerance, with flexibility, with achieving goals, with observing their environment and their, you know, what's happening in the world, with managing their time, with defining tasks, with prioritizing and planning. Like, quiet as it's kept, most humans are actually low functioning when we think about the mastery of executive functioning skills. And so when I hear her talk about low functioning, I get the trigger word, like low, what you mean? Functioning, I'm not slow. Nobody's calling you slow. However, if we take a look at these different domains, if we think transparently, how are you doing with managing your impulses, managing your emotions, managing your time, communicating your needs, dealing with disappointment? Like, how are you actually doing with those things? And if people are being honest with themselves, they struggle in a lot of these different areas of these executive functioning skills. But I know, like, he was actively triggered. He was actively in his head. He was actively defensive. Even when she had a conversation with him about wanting more kids after he already has 8 kids with 3 different mothers of those children, And her being very adamant that, like, yeah, I could date anybody I want to date. I do not want to date a man that has kids. And him just not being able to understand it, because you can certainly tell he'd be around a whole bunch of pick me's because he has high value, right? Like, he got money, he's 6'5", he all the shit, right? He high value, but his functioning is low. And so he could not for the world grasp the fact that this black, successful, high functioning, high value woman don't want shit to do with his ass. And there's a lot of people like that out in the world, right? Like, no, like our functioning is not aligned, our values might be aligned, but at the end of the day, like, everything that you could do for me in terms of value wise, I could do for myself. And so if you're not functioning right by yourself, there's no way you're gonna function well in a relationship with somebody who's looking for a deeper understanding. Right, looking for somebody with a deeper understanding of these skill sets on how to function in a relationship with themselves, in society, at work, at Trader Joe's, wherever you might be. And so I would highly encourage people, if you have not had a chance to watch this conversation with Cam Newton and Dr. Bryant, like, do it. It's going to piss you off. He's going to absolutely piss you off because he's annoying. And most people who are low functioning, they are annoying. Right? Like, when you have a different set of executive functioning skills or different way that you interpret the world and manage your emotions, like, people who struggle to do it, but yet put on a facade like they got that shit together, they are absolutely annoying. So you're going to be annoyed as you watch the interview, but it's also going to be like, yo, like, this is a really beautiful way to kind of learn new techniques on how to challenge thoughts that just, like, don't make any sense, but then at the same time, like, call people out, not always in, but literally out on the bullshit. I will say, a part of the conversation that did piss me off, because it's a reality of a lot of black women, there were so many times where Dr. Bryant had to be like, Cam, like, literally had to lower her voice, like, Cam, I'm saying this with love, I'm saying this with respect. You are a great father, you would never do this, but blah, blah, blah. Like, just had to feed his ego to disarm him, to get him to maybe receive, instead of, like, being able to shoot it to him straight. Like, she literally could not do that. His defense was so high, his ego was so big, like, in his own way. And I know, like, countless people that I have dealt with, like, men in particular, who, like, that ego be so high, defense is so high, where you have to feed it, honestly, to get them to disarm them, to try to, I don't know, make progress. Which is incredibly exhausting. So I'm hopeful that after that little almost 3 hour exchange that Dr. Bryant had with Cam Newton, that she had a plan to take care of herself, because I know she felt depleted after that shit. There's no way she could not. There's no way she could not. So yeah, just watch it. It's on YouTube. And the last thing in terms of Earth is Ghetto, we're not going to talk fully about it today because I still got to watch episode two. And I feel like we're getting like three or four episodes of Chimp Crazy on HBO. Because we got to find out what she done did with, what is that baby name? That doggone chimp that that woman stole. Hold on, Chimp Crazy. Because she definitely took a chimp from the sanctuary. Tonka, yes, child. That white woman then stole Tonka. She's somewhere in Vegas or something. I don't listen. Breastfeeding these chimpanzees, fall in love. She they mama, all types of stuff. The animal rights people then had to come in and swoop and take the chimps off the sanctuary. People's lives falling apart, and this woman then stole a chimp. And so y'all know how I feel about a good old white mess time. And so I am locked in for Chimp Crazy. I'm not ready to give my full review because, like I said, I gotta watch all the episodes. But once I watch all the episodes, I'm gonna be back. And Tonka better be returned safely to the sanctuary. And she better stop breastfeeding these chimps, because we got a lot to talk about when I get to the end of this docuseries. But that's all we got for Earth is Ghetto for the week. Let's go ahead and transition into Tales from the Trap. All right, Tales from the Trap is real brief, it's real quick this week. I recall a story of when I was working in the psychiatric hospital, So like many of us in the field, you know, we have multiple jobs at a time. So I was actually working at the psych hospital on PRN, so you know, as needed shifts. The same time I was working part-time at a residential group home for adolescent boys. And then so I had a full-time job where I worked as a therapist for the behavioral health doc. It's like a drug court for the juvenile court system. So I had three jobs at this time, and one of them being working at the psych hospital. And the floor that I worked on in the psych hospital was like the mood disorder floor. And sometimes you would have like thought disorder on that floor, but it was primarily mood disorder. So, you know, depression, like PTSD, anxiety, borderline, like those would be the kind of folk, you know, diagnoses that would end up on my floor. Like sometimes you would get substance use detox, but there was a whole nother unit for that. But if there was some, you know, comorbidity where they didn't have to do detox first, they would come to the mood disorder floor. Anyway, a lot of information. But I'm working in the psych hospital. This is also my first job working only with adults. And I picked that out intentionally because all my career up until that point had been with young people and their birth and their chosen families. And so I was like, if I'm going to get me another job, because I needed one at the time because I was saving to buy a house, I'm going to get at the psych hospital and put me on the adult floor so that like I could learn this stuff or just get experience in this world. And I'm so grateful that I was working on the adult psych floor for almost 2 years, and everything that I was exposed to and what I learned about myself, but also learned like this shit is real. Like mental health. I know we joke about the DSM all day long, but baby, like some of that shit in the DSM is bullshit, but some of that shit in the DSM is very real. And I was able to see a lot of it up close and personal when I worked at the psych hospital. But the story that really shifted my understanding on how to better show up for humans and to get out of my own head and like make sure I wasn't at the center of the day, if that makes sense, is, you know, when you get to work, or if you kind of know the setting of working in a hospital, when you know you get to the hospital, you're typically in the staff room where you lock your things up, you log in, you clock in or whatever, you kind of get yourself together before then you go on to the actual unit where patients and the nurses are and everything is kind of happening, right? And so I did that and I walk onto the unit. And as you know, like you typically give your salutations, good morning, hello, hey, good morning, hello, how you doing? Good morning, good morning. Well, actually, I really wouldn't say how you doing because I wasn't prepared to deal with it. So I would just kind of say, good morning, hey, good morning, good morning. But I got to this one woman and I said, good morning. And she looked at me and said, ain't nothing good about the morning. And it hit me like it didn't really startle me. It didn't make me feel like, why is she talking to me like this? It made me think like, yo, she's absolutely right. And like, she went on to talk about like, every morning not good for me. And, you know, we had a little brief exchange, but that has stuck with me for what, like seven years now, because it's true. And it shifted the way that I greet people in the mornings or just in general. I always don't put the good in front of it. Right? Because she was absolutely correct. Like every morning is not good for everybody. And then for me, not getting trapped into that like positive bullshit, well, we're gonna make it good. Every morning's a good morning when we blah. Nah, like we could be cool with the morning not being good. All right. Like I can learn to be good with the morning not being good and not trying to make it better for somebody who ain't ready to hear that shit. And there's a lot of people who need that lesson. Where they, you know, oh, good morning, make every day a great day. Like, no, I really don't want today to be great. Like, today's just not a good day for me. Right now, it's not a good moment for me. And I don't need you to try to make it better. I need you to acknowledge, like, I'm just not having a good moment right now. It doesn't mean I'm gonna stay this way, but right now, it's not good. And I will never forget. And I'm so grateful that she offered me that lesson that she probably didn't even know she gave. And I have held that all of these years, and it changes my approach, especially with just, you know, clients or just people in general. I don't often lead with like, good morning. It's just, you know, how are you showing up today? How are you right now? Like that type of stuff. But that good morning stuff, she shut that shit down for me. She shut me clear down and gave me a meaningful lesson that more practitioners need to understand is things are not always good for people. It is not our job or responsibility to make them good in that moment. We can acknowledge with that person that they're not having a good morning, a good moment, a good day. We can let it not be good for as long as it needs to not be good. And then we can try to develop a plan on what could better look like. But for me, it was a lesson of, all right, it's not a good morning and I don't have to fix this. I don't have to fix it. And how many of us could learn to understand that we don't always have to fix stuff. We can just kind of, we can let them be what it is. And so that is my tales from the trap for the week. I'm going to move us into a good Black word, which is a reoccurring word, but I believe it is a necessary word. And it kind of goes into tales from a trap, which is I'm coming back to tell y'all to do less. Do less. Stop fixing problems you didn't create. Stop fixing problems you don't have the tools to fix or solve for. Stop taking on responsibilities that you're not paid to deal with, not assigned to deal with. Right? Like just do less. I know it sounds strange, it sounds foreign, it doesn't sound possible, but when you really take inventory on how much you're actually doing, if you just did one less thing of whatever that is, no one's probably gonna notice. But your body will, your mind will, if you just do less. Because, like I've said before, and I'll continue to say, like, it doesn't matter how much you do, there will always be more to do. You're never going to get it all done. Capitalism will never allow us to get it all done. And so, just by doing less, you give back to yourselves in ways that, ooh, the gratitude that your mind and body and spirit and soul will offer to you. If you just do less. I'm not saying do nothing at all. I'm simply saying do a bit less of what you're already doing, whatever that means for you. Right? So, like for me, when I think about all my responsibilities at work or just on, you know, with my business or with all these creative projects, I really make I got a little post-it note. For the day, I put four things on that note, post-it note that are actually realistically that I can achieve. And one of them will honestly be like, check emails, respond to emails, draft an email, right? So like it'll be tasks like that, not a big shit. Sometimes it's big, but if it's a big project, it's just the one thing on the post-it. But I put like no more than four things on a post-it. And once I'm done with that for the day is done. I don't make new work. For what? Like, I could do it tomorrow. And if I can't do it tomorrow, nobody knows but me. But do less, y'all. You deserve it. You don't have to earn it. And there are wealthy people across this land that woke up and didn't do shit today while you're ripping and running. There are people across this world. Wealth or no wealth, honestly, that woke up and they ain't do shit today. And they were not going to do shit tomorrow. You work with some of these people that don't do shit at work. So do less. That is my good Black word for the day. Y'all, I appreciate you deeply. Thank you for rocking with me. As you already know, like, please remember to take care of your heart so that we can take care of each other. Because at the end of the day, we is all we got. And I will chat with y'all next time.